Genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're live every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is smart radio with sharp questions aimed at intelligent guests. It's talk radio done right for the 21st century. If you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. And you want to keep the number handy because I have lots of giveaways today. I've got two tickets for Moonlight at the Ranch 5. Those are $120 value. And I've got four sandwiches or four salads from Urbane Cafe. We'll be giving both of those prizes away just a little bit later in the show. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is technology's impact on our outlook. Each of my guests will explain how technology can impact our view of things. My first guest is a former Duke University professor and an expert on changes in education based on technologies. We'll discuss her findings in her latest book, Now You See It. My second guest believes that change is our friend and technology is his bride. Well, we'll debate whether it's time for a divorce. My third guest is an optimistic guy. We'll discuss The Skeptic's Guide to Positive Thinking in Business from his book, Filling the Glass. And as always, if you want to join in the conversation or ask a question, call us at 639-0008. Kathy Davidson served from 1998 to 2006 as the first vice provost for interdisciplinary studies at Duke University, where she helped create the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience and the program in Information Science and Information Studies. She's the co-founder of Humanities, Arts, Science, and Technology Advanced Collaboration, and that is an abbreviated, that's pronounced Haystack. It's a network of innovative inventors dedicated to new forms of learning for the digital age. Kathy has published more than 20 books, including her latest book, Now You See It, How Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. She blogs regularly on new media, learning, and innovation on the Haystack sign. Her call letters, if you will, on the blog is Cat in the Stack. Haystack is dedicated to rethinking learning in our schools and for our own information age. Welcome to the show, Kathy. How are you today?
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Billy.
Well, thanks for being our guest. You truly are a thought leader, and I've been wanting to have you on the show because I first read about you in 2003, although I didn't know that it was you at the time. I'm an alumnus of Duke University, and I read that the class of 2007 received iPods when they matriculated to Duke. So I thought it was interesting, but also I have to say, I thought it was wasteful at the time.
Are you one of the people that wrote me those?
I was not one of the hate mail, no.
Letters.
Not one of the hate mail writers. However, I did think that, well, what's going on here? 8 years later, though, I better understand, and now I can truly say, now I see it. So why did Duke, and why did you in particular, drive to give Duke freshmen iPods when they came in that year and every year since?
First of all, I had an amazing job at Duke. It was a new position created kind of for the cranky person on campus. It was me. And it was the president of Duke, Nan Kohan, at one point jokingly said, the job is to break things and make things. And one of the things in particular was to think about the way that this thing called a research university, which was developed for the industrial age, could be changed. And it's not easy to change a university,
Boy.
But how it could be changed for a digital age. So Apple came to us and said, what technology would you like to partner with us on? And they offered us laptops and other things. And I was in the room with several other people. I'd certainly not all me, but several other people. And we said, well, what do young people like? If this is the age where people are making their own technology, what technologies could we experiment with? And I don't know if you remember the ads for the iPods at the time. It was like silhouettes on bright colors of people with hair flying,
yes,
listening to their iPods. It had nothing to do with learning. So we gave the iPods to first-year students. This was before iUniversity existed. iTunes barely existed. I think there were like seven things on iTunes at the time. So no one had any idea about learning applications. But we gave them to the first-year students within a day. The second, third, and fourth-year students were saying, hey, we paid Duke tuition too. And we said, oh, my gosh, what a mistake. How about this? What if you convince a professor to do something with their syllabus that will include iPods and come up with a real learning application for the iPods in your field and in your classes, and we'll give you, your teacher, and every student in the class a free iPod. Well, I'm not saying that was Machiavellian, but it was a great motivator, because if you just give stuff to people for free, especially young, well, any of us, we kind of throw it in the drawer or we use it, but we don't think about it. Suddenly, there was this great competition to come up with uses. But the more important thing, to put students in the driver's seat. Students were having to think about learning in their courses and convince professors to do it. And what the surprise, the big, well, there were many surprises, but the first surprise is professors loved it. We thought they would dislike it, and if as administrators we said, be innovative, they would have protested. But because their very own students would come to them and say, because they had to persuade them, right? They would
right.
say, wow, this is a great class, and I bet we could make it even better if we used this iPod to think about heart arrhythmias and to, you know, like a medical student, to connect this to the National Library of Heart Arrhythmias. And I bet we could change the signal processing so we could put a stethoscope in one ear and the iPod earbud in the other, and we could measure heart arrhythmias. Or what if in my music class, we've worked on the iPod such that I could play my violin and dump it into a recording on the using the iPod of the Philadelphia Philharmonic or the Philadelphia Symphony playing a symphony with my violin in it. And that happened in just about every department of the university. And again, it wasn't just the things we did, which are, in, you know, Steve Jobs is no fool. He probably made a million or billions on the technology Duke students invented. What was cool was saying we're in a new era where students have some expertise that if you put it in the right way, they can share to help innovate at the standard stodgy institution called a research university.
Well, that's very interesting. My guest is Kathy Davidson. We're talking about her latest book, Now You See It, and it took me a while, 8 years, in fact, to see why she put iPods into the hands of freshmen coming into Duke University. But tell me overall, as an educator, as an administrator, what was gained by using the iPods in education, Kathy?
I think the single gain was, it might have even been a bigger gain for the students and the faculty, was to say we think that this new world of do-it-yourself online, this world where anybody, this moment in communication where anybody can have an idea and post it to the web for just about anyone in the world to see instantly, has real learning possibilities. And we want this experiment to just begin, not only to tell us what those learning possibilities are, but how we as learners and as teachers and as co-learners of teachers and students together can change the educational process in the way that will be best suited to the world that you students are inheriting.
All right. That makes some sense. Now, Kathy, in your book, you write that there's actually a quote in there. Somebody else said this. In all human history, there have been four great information ages, and we're in the fourth one. What are the four ages, and what makes today's one of the most transformational periods, in your opinion?
Yes, that was said by the very, very eminent historian Robert Darnton, who's won many, many prizes and who's now the head of the library system at Harvard. He was a distinguished professor at Princeton and was invited to come change careers at, you know, in his 50s or 60s, and now head the library school at Harvard, which was visionary because he really believes this is the fourth great information age in human history. The first is the invention of writing in ancient Mesopotamia in 4000 BC. And as you, I'm sure, know, Billy, Socrates didn't like it. You know, Socrates thought writing is going to ruin our memory. It's going to ruin our attention. Writing things down is such a simplistic, mechanical thing to do. Interaction, dialogue is what real humans are about. This is less than human.
Right, so, I remember.
He was one of the first protesters against the information age. The second is the invention of movable type, and that happens in 10th century China and then with Gutenberg in the Renaissance in Europe. The third is the age that's actually the area I was trained in as a historian of technology, and that's the late 18th and early 19th century, when steam-powered presses and machine-produced paper and ink made books cheap enough that middle-class people and even working-class people could buy or borrow them through the new institution of the circulating library that put popular books. It changed the whole demographics of printing. Lots of popular books that featured popular characters, especially the novel. The novel was kind of the video game of the 18th century. And now we're suddenly, we live in a broadcast yourself world where anybody can contribute content to the web, where you have something like Wikipedia, where 90,000 people have together, without pay, without much direction, voluntarily written and edited each other's entries to make the largest encyclopedia, 282 languages, the world has ever known. And the American Library Association, which has tested this many times, now says it's as accurate as any existing encyclopedia. That's just amazing. We are truly in the fourth great information age in human history.
Well, that is information. Very interesting, Kathy. My guest is Kathy Davidson, author of the book, Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. And let me just question you a little bit further on Wikipedia, because Wikipedia, I love it. I use it all the time in my job. But the reality is that these are amateurs putting the information in there. And I question the accuracy of it. I know that it's a self-policing, crowdsourced tool that everybody in there goes in and corrects things that they find as mistakes. I guess I question whether it can be as good as material that's edited, and I don't want to throw up the Encyclopedia Britannica because that is ancient history, but the reality is the vetting, the editorial review that an encyclopedia or some other document has, certainly has value even today. So how can Wikipedia compete with the editorial value that an editor brings to all this?
Well, first of all, a little insider story. I'm told that the biggest problem at Wikipedia now is not the vetting, but there's too much vetting. People are worried it's going to get just as stodgy as most encyclopedias because there's too many people vetting and editors love to edit. That's one part. Two, several years ago, it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, I was writing a blog about calculus, and I was a math major as a kid and always wanted to be a math person growing up. But my definition of calculus was clunky, so I went to Wikipedia to find a succinct definition of calculus. And there was all this stuff, not just about Newton and Leibniz, there was all this stuff about ancient Egypt and ancient India and China and the Arabic Middle Ages, and I thought, this isn't this. No. This isn't how calculus was invented. So I called the head of the reference librarians at Duke, and I said, is this true, what they're saying about all these contributions that led to the development of calculus? This is not the great Enlightenment math that I've believed all this time. And she took a week to get back to me, and the only way she could verify the Wikipedia entrance was by looking for her equivalent in Egypt, India, China. I can't remember the other countries, but there were several other countries. She went to the best librarians in those countries, had them read the Wikipedia entry, and verify the information. The point being, that information, which turned out to be 100% accurate, did not exist in not only any other encyclopedia, but in any reference book in any of those countries. So the Chinese could verify all the Chinese information. The Egyptians could have verified the Egyptian information. The person, and I believe it was Iran, was able to verify that information. But nobody had all of the information that was in the entry, but independently they each were able to verify it. That is an information revolution.
Without a doubt, we're living in wonderful times. My guest is Kathy Davidson. Kathy, this interview is going to make me sound like a real curmudgeon here, but the cynic in me says that our schools, they were set up to make sure that we could get to the factory on time, have the minimum skills that we needed to do repetitive tasks. It really wasn't about our education at all. As we moved out of the industrial age into the informational age into the 1980s, our schools haven't kept up. In fact, our politicians are really inventing tests and compensation plans based on improving the old, outdated ways of creating. So what do we need to move education into the 21st century?
Well, I agree with you 100%. You know, people always say the school bell is the symbol of public education. It's because if you're a farmer, you get up with the sun, you do the task that needs to be done, you take a break when you feel you need a break, and kids had to be taught how to do things all at the same time, all at the same age, all on the same subject, finish on time. The time test is a really weird thing when you think about it. Why are you smarter because you can do something in 15 minutes instead of 16? I mean, you know, it's very odd. We had to be trained for 120 years to an extremely eccentric way of thinking. I agree with you 100% that we're now coming up with almost punishments to teachers and schools and school districts for not being trained to this very eccentric way of thinking. You know, in your job and in my job, I don't set a timer. And if I have a problem to solve, no one pops into the room and says, Kathy, on your budget, is it A, you know, overhead, B, indirect cost recovery, C, you know, it's just not there. And if my kid is learning A, B, C, D, E thinking in school, he then goes home, turns on his computer, and the whole world is there that he has to judge. I mean, I noted that multiple choice test was invented by somebody in 1914, and the first example question that Frederick Kelly makes is like, which of these is a farm animal? Dog, cow, dinosaur, crocodile. Well, first of all, if you're a farm kid, you have to pretend you don't know that a dog is a farm animal. But second, if you go online today, and that's still the kind of test we ask kids, if you go online today and you put in farm animal, I tested this, you get 22 million responses. What about school today is teaching kids how you sort through 22 million responses?
Well, I agree.
Or even Google ranks, which is the most important. How do you train a kid to think critically and say, I don't know that cow is a more important farm animal than dog. My family are sheep herders. Dogs are a lot more important than cows are. You know, there's all that kind of serious, engaged thinking that we've pretended for 150 years aren't what life is about, but every employer knows that is what life is about. That's what work is about.
Oh, that's amazing. My guest is Kathy Davidson. So, Kathy, I'm going to make you queen for a day. Now, you need to be a benevolent queen, but what would you do to change the education system for the better? What would you do?
Okay, well, first, I would get rid of end-of-grade testing. We know it only tests about 25% of the knowledge in a class. It makes everybody stressed out, and it's useless. So just get rid of it. Second, if we need a national system of accreditation, computer scientists right now are working on really marvelous ways of real-time, in-time testing, where the kind of testing where if I take an algebra if I have an algebra problem online and I do badly, it'll kick back a new question to me and it'll make it a little bit easier. It doesn't say I'm failing, it just makes it a little easier. Then if I do well on that, it might challenge me by making it two steps harder. And all that data can be collected. So at the end of a day, a teacher knows who's doing well, or even in the moment, who's doing well, who isn't. But it uses that concept of the challenge, sort of that's as old as the spelling bee. We know that works when kids are challenged in that way, especially if we can get them to work in groups. It's a far more effective way of teaching a subject where they're not being tested by externals, but tested specifically by their own ability. And fortunately, I work with some of the greatest computer scientists in the world, and many of them are actually giving up. Many made money in the computer revolution. They're giving up their jobs in order to work on this new form of testing that they know we have the evidence is going to be a really revolutionary way of testing.
Wow.
Also, yesterday, I'm part of the Digital Media and Learning Competition with the MacArthur Foundation. We announced our fourth competition, which is called Badges for Lifelong Learning. And Secretary of Education Duncan was there, the head of NASA was there, the head of the Manufacturing Institute of America, which are dealing mostly with often with kids who've dropped out of high school but still have fabulous skills, but we don't have vocational schools anymore that can credit or give credit to those kids. And PBS was there, and many other people who are excited about this idea of a digital portfolio where if you're a good contribute to one of those Wikipedia entries, somebody might give you points that you can put on a digital resume. If you write a blog, you might get points. But also if you have real life skills, you might credit a kind of ongoing portfolio. We don't think that's going to solve all the problems, but it's fascinating to have so many powerful people and everyday individuals thinking about, okay, if we're inventing the multiple choice test for the 21st century, some way that we can measure our standards in schools, what would a non-standardized, because we live in such a non-standardized way, what a non-standardized way of recording, measuring, testing, and inspiring high standards, what would that be? So we've just launched a new competition, and we're gonna see what we get. It's a problem, not a problem solver. It's something we can think about together.
A discussion starter. My guest has been Kathy Davidson. You're a real ball of fire, Kathy. She's the author of the book, Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. Kathy, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about some of these projects that you're involved in, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, my download Now You See It, of course, is in my book. It's the first way. But the second way is to go to www.haystack, and that's a terrible acronym, but we're stuck with it, HASTAC.org. Or to go to the MacArthur Foundation's Digital Media and Learning Initiative.
Oh, that is great. Kathy, it has been a delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Thank you.